Dreams like the spring sun kissing the flowers from the snow, to grow, to bloom, to impart their scent as they dream, fading softly at your breast and then sinking into the grave. Music by Richard Wagner, orchestrated by Felix Mottl, words by Mathilde Wesendonck. In Träume, the dreams of both Richard and Mathilde. The last of the five Wesendonck Lieder performed here in the Royal Albert Hall by the soprano Anna Katharina Antonacci for the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nezet-Séguin. Wagner wrote in his diary, "I've done nothing better than those songs, and there's very little that I've written that can be placed alongside them." Yannick Nezet-Séguin was telling me he'd only recently conducted his first Wagner opera, Lohengrin, in Montreal, and he enjoys the intimacy of these songs, an intimacy which he feels is more prevalent in the operas than we often think. He likes the direct expression in those songs. Back come the two. Anna Katharina Antonacci and Yannick Nezet-Séguin, deep in conversation until they got onto the platform. She's continuing the black and white theme. Black top to the breast, white skirt. There's this extraordinary voice, which is a kind of mixture of mezzo-soprano and soprano. I think it's called a falcon in Italy. She's certainly going to be carrying on performing Carmen, which is one of her signature roles, Santa Fe, and here at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, Cassandra in Berlioz the Trojans in Milan and Vienna. Well, after the interval, the Rotterdam Philharmonic and Yannick Nezet-Séguin returned to the platform here in the Albert Hall to perform Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, which he pronounced, at least for the benefit of the Soviet authorities, to be about the grandeur of the human spirit. Meanwhile, for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, in tonight's Proms Plus, recorded early this evening at the Royal College of Music, we find out about the relationship of life in the Soviet Union to Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony. The presenter is James Jolly.
Welcome to this Proms Plus event, which we're going to be focusing on Serge Prokofiev and his Soviet years. Fiona McKnight is archivist of the Serge Prokofiev Archive at Goldsmiths, University of London. She studied music and education at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama and the University of Glasgow. David Nees, no stranger to Radio 3, is the author of a number of books on composers, including the first volume in a biography of Prokofiev, From Russia to the West, 1891 to 1935. And he tells me that volume 2 is now underway. Now, Prokofiev is one of those composers who, with the wisdom of hindsight, you think, why did he do that? How could he possibly have done that? So to sort of set up the Soviet years, I thought maybe we could sort of jog through the early part of his biography, and maybe, David, you could start us off.
Right, well, he was a true Petersburger, I suppose you could say, in training, although he was actually brought up on a country estate in the Ukraine, a pampered only child. His mother had lost two children before she had him, and he went to the great St. Petersburg Conservatoire. Most of the students in his class were at least 10 years older, including his lifelong friend, Nikolai Myaskovsky, and he was a precocious improviser. He'd written lots of little spiky piano pieces for family and friends and carried on doing that throughout the first years of his training. Curious to think of him as a pioneer, but in some ways he was. The Scythian suite, I suppose, of 1913-14, which was commissioned by Serge Diaghilev after they'd met in London, but rejected by him as being perhaps a bit too much like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which of course was premiered in 1913, was resuscitated as an orchestral suite, which shocked the rather conservative Russian public, Petrograd public, as it was in 1916, because of course the war had broken out. As far as symphonies went, he started an early symphony in a kind of competition with his friend Mieszkowski, and said to him, wrote to him, that he thought that a symphony should never be longer than about 20 or 25 minutes, because what can be worse than a boring symphony? So symphony number 5, we know, is 45 minutes long. So in the end, he towed the line and wrote big symphonies, but it certainly wasn't that way with his first offering, of course, the Classical Symphony, which was one of the last works he composed before he left Russia in a very turbulent state in the wake of the 1917 revolution, to travel to try and find his fortune, in fact, in America, a visit which he thought would only last 6 months, and of course he ended up not going back until 1927.
Do you want to take over the story from there and take us up to the sort of return to Russia?
It's, Prokofiev's life is full of drama, I suppose, and that, you know, he left St. Petersburg on what turned out to be the last train to get across to the Far East, and he sailed. He was intended to go to South America, I think, but he missed a boat. And there wasn't another one for a month. So he had a little stay in Japan and then ended up going to the United States instead.
Where would his sympathies have been at the time of the revolution? I mean, on which side?
As so often, he was simply interested in writing music and having it performed. And the circumstances just weren't there. The opportunities weren't there for him to do that at the time. So very in typical sort of single-minded, you know, style, he decided to go and try it elsewhere. So he got to America with, as he said, you know, a few pennies in his pocket. He had to borrow money from people on the boat, and he borrowed money again to get across America to New York, where he had Russians who had already gone. He had contacts there, and started trying to get primarily recitals. So he was in New York for a few years. That's where Love for Three Oranges was composed. But he met with mixed success. Rachmaninoff was there before him, and his style was absolutely what I think they expected, you know, another Russian coming over. So he left and he headed to Europe, where initially he settled in Bavaria and then went to Paris, where, of course, there's a huge Russian emigre community already. And he remained there, or based in Paris, we should say, until the end of 1935. I say based in Paris because he spent huge amounts of his time touring, but he constantly complained that he had no time to compose because he was always away giving concerts. By this point, he had married in 1924. He had two children in 24 and 28. And by the mid-20s, he was talking in his diaries about going back to Russia. He was very interested. He was receiving an odd word of a commission here and there, opportunities. He was hearing about his music being performed in Russia, which wasn't happening easily for him in Europe. He was working with Diaghilev, but he was always on the fringes, never quite the, you know, Stravinsky was there again. He was there before him, and he was first in Diaghilev's book. So when these overtures from Russia started to come, he thought seriously about it, but he was very wary, and he wanted assurances that if he did go, he would be able to leave again. By 1927, he was persuaded of this, and he did go with his wife on a tour, which was a massive success. From then on, in 1928, 29, 30, the end of the 20s, early 30s, he spent more and more time in Russia. So we talk about this move at the end of 35, 36, but really it was more of a gradual shift of his base of operations from being based in Paris and touring in Russia to being based in Russia and, he thought, still continuing to tour in the West. But it didn't turn out like that.
So David, the Soviets wanted him back. I mean, he was, you know, the biggest composer they could probably most likely get back. They clearly couldn't get Rachmaninoff back. They couldn't get Stravinsky back. They badly wanted him, didn't they?
Yes, and he badly wanted them in a sense that, I mean, he felt homesick, but he also liked the idea of writing music for a larger public. He wanted to communicate. He wanted to write music for children. He even wanted to write this fabulous cantata celebrating the 20th anniversary of the October Revolution, because he'd seen what the young Shostakovich had done in the 1920s, which was a period of incredible experimentation in the Soviet Union. I mean, not just in art with Malevich and so on, photography, but in music, I mean, works like Berg's Wozzeck were still being performed in Russia, Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier. Anything went at that point. But there was also this new strain of avant-garde art, of which Shostakovich was one of the representatives. And of course, in his second symphony, which was officially a cantata to October for the 10th anniversary of the October Revolution, he'd thrown in everything but the kitchen sink and written in a very experimental way. And Prokofiev, in the mid-1930s, thought he could do the same. Of course, not for the first time in his life, his timing was bad. And the work that he then wrote, this wonderfully inventive and peculiar between the lines cantata, was something that would have been acceptable in the 30s, in the 1920s, but the atmosphere had changed in the mid-1930s. One of the things that Prokofiev and many other composers, it has to be said, misunderstood was that the proletarian musicians' organizations, which had made his life absolute hell in the late 20s and early 30s, were dissolved and everything was brought under a general aegis for the Association of Soviet Musicians. And he didn't realize, who did at the time, that this was actually an attempt to bring everything under state control. And of course, state control by that stage meant Stalin. So he didn't read the signs, but who can blame him?
Now, he comes back to the Soviet Union. The promises look good. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, the kind of the trap closes and he's stuck there.
Yes. Yes, he was able to tour twice up until 1938. And, of course, famously on the 1938 tour, he was offered a contract by Disney and I think Paramount as well, yes, to stay there and to write for them. But his two sons had been left behind in the Soviet Union. They hadn't got permission to travel. So he had no choice but to go back. And I think he and his wife, you know, certainly realised as they went back, they were unlikely to return. And when they returned, his permit to travel externally was exchanged and that was it. He never left the Soviet Union again. And that at that point, 1938, we can start to sort of trace the kind of his personal life falling apart a little. Problems in his marriage. His wife, of course, was not Russian. So while his position was not easy, hers was really difficult. He was a composer and he had commissions and he had work to do. She was a singer but was struggling to get any work whatsoever in a foreign country. She spoke Russian perfectly well, but she had loved the lifestyle in Paris and America. She was a European, and it did not suit her at all. So the things started to fall apart in the marriage, and he eventually left Lena in 1941, and for another woman who he spent the rest of his life with.
And Lena's life turned very
And Lena's life went very much downhill, because as soon as, you know, as the wife of Prokofiev, who was, you know, one of the principal composers of the Soviet Union, she had a degree of protection. But during the war, Prokofiev was evacuated to the Caucasus and to Georgia and various places with Mira Mendelssohn, his new wife, although Lena would claim that they had never divorced, so she was actually his only wife. Lena was left behind in Moscow throughout the war with their two sons, and, you know, suffered during it, and then eventually was arrested in 1948 and spent 8 years in a labour camp in the north. And in fact wasn't released until after Prokofiev's death. He had died in 1953 and she was released in 56.
Let's sort of move to the symphonies. As David was saying, he wrote the Classical Symphony in 1918. Then there were three symphonies sort of during the 20s, which two of them based on dramatic works, Fiery Angel and then Prodigal Son. Then there was quite a large gap until 1944, when the symphony we're going to hear was written. But in that period, late 30s, he wrote Romeo and Juliet, and it always strikes me as extraordinary that here's a work of Prokofiev that is incredibly accessible, unbelievably successful, but the birth pains were absolutely horrendous.
Yes, I mean, the composition of it was as easy as anything for him. He wrote it in a single summer at a country retreat for the Bolshoi artists in 1935, and it was done with incredible rapidity. And then the problems kicked in about the choice of the ending, which, believe it or not, was actually Prokofiev's and his librettist Sergei Radlov's choice, to have a happy ending in which the lovers did not die but were reunited in the nick of time. And we've actually seen this reconstruction with a rather, in my mind, slightly unsatisfactory choreography by Mark Morris, which didn't do it a great deal of favours, but it was interesting to see this fantasy ending with the music that you never hear in Prokofiev's ballet when you see the Kenneth MacMillan choreography, which of course remains incomparably the greatest, hasn't really been challenged. Maybe John Cranko has challenged it, but that's the one that remains. And we see it as one of perhaps the four great Russian ballet scores after Swan Lake, The Sleeping Beauty and The Nutcracker. Romeo and Juliet unquestionably is on that level, but it took a long time to be accepted because the authority of all people weren't happy with the changing of the Shakespearean ending. And so things also soured in 36, which of course was the very month, January, February, the very time that Prokofiev finally settled the family in Moscow, but still had this sort of 6 months away, 6 months at home arrangement. At that very point, Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk came under attack in Pravda after two successful years. And then, of course, Soviet composers were very much under restraint. Prokofiev was on tour at the time it happened, so he hardly noticed it. But, of course, by the time he got back, he must have realised that things had turned out not at all as he had expected. And then, of course, there was a long interregnum, and Romeo and Juliet only finally reached the stage after many alterations, new numbers added to the score, and, of course, this completely different ending, with Galina Ulanova as Juliet, who was among the dancers, it has to be said, who complained about the score, because when they learnt it in rehearsals with a repetiteur, a pianist, they could hear everything. And, of course, a lot of the score is very chamber musical. When it came to an orchestra, they thought this is difficult to dance to, and she didn't like it. She changed her tune eventually.
And the Fifth Symphony very much draws on the same languages as Romeo and Juliet. And it's one of his very, very few works that seem to emerge almost effortlessly. There was no problem with the authorities. There was very little musical problem.
Absolutely. It's sort of refreshing to talk about a work of Prokofiev's that didn't have, because Romeo and Juliet was the first of several that, you know, that this happened with. You know, by the time he wrote the Fifth Symphony, he was already working on War and Peace, which he spent the rest of his life revising, and never saw it performed. Semyon Kotko, huge problems, all sorts of problems, not just that the music wasn't satisfactory, but the people that he was working with came under unfavourable attention and were arrested. So the Fifth Symphony, very unusually...
And he wrote it at a large part of it at Ivanovo, which was this sort of Soviet holiday home, I suppose, for composers, with some very illustrious companions.
Yes, Shostakovich was there. Prokofiev referred to it in letters as the state chicken farm, and he worked, you know, he was a terribly disciplined and efficient composer, and he got up early in the morning and he sat at his desk until 6 o'clock, and then while others like Shostakovich were playing tennis or football, he would play bridge or chess, and that was his relaxation, and it suited him terribly well, because he'd spent all these years, you know, trying to compose on trains, you know, between touring from one concert to another, and this is what he had been seeking in a way, the space and the time to compose. And despite the fact that this was during the war, his Prokofiev's war years were terribly productive. He composed a huge amount of music. He was evacuated, along with all the major composers, to the Caucasus and so on. And he just produced music. And the Fifth Symphony, as you say, does share, well, it shares material with the happy ending of Romeo and Juliet. Some of that music which wasn't used, in typical Prokofiev style, he recycled it. He considered it good material. He didn't want to waste it, and he used it in the second movement of the Fifth Symphony. And he does this a lot. And actually, some of the other material he used his favoured method of composition, which was he had sketchbooks, notebooks, really, in which he wrote down themes, just melodies. Few bars, and he did this throughout his life. And when he came to put a work together, it was often a case of putting it together from thematic material that he had written, often many years before. Some of the material in the Fifth Symphony can be dated to the early 30s.
And he conducted the premiere himself, and it was a great success. But the circumstances of the premiere were somewhat unusual, or the timing, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, Sviatoslav Richter writes about this beautifully in his memoirs, about the fact that just before the start, when Prokofiev, as he described it, stood like a noble statue on the podium, the guns were heard saluting the Red Army's crossing of the Vistula, so it was a real turning point in the war. And I suppose that and Prokofiev's official, and I feel always wrongly taken, statement, it's Soviet speak, pure and simple, that this is a symphony of the triumph of the human spirit, have led it to be hailed as a great war symphony. And what fascinates me is that it is certainly taking its cue from another symphony, which was a corrective to something chaotic and anarchic. That's to say, Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, after the incredible experimentalism of his Fourth, which had reached final rehearsals in 36 and then was withdrawn. That was the kind of cue for the sort of symphony you should write. And yet what fascinates me is not the correspondences with Shostakovich's Fifth. And of course, remember, fifths are very important. Beethoven is the model. It's a progress from darkness to light, therefore. If you look at Prokofiev's Fifth, it's not a progress from darkness to light at all. It's something very different. He'd actually done that in an interim work, which we could say is the missing link symphonically. Symphonic song, short piece, which really does start with darkness, then struggle, then achievement, a big, beautiful melody. The sort of melodies that Prokofiev newly manufactured as he was moving back to Russia. This was a new phase in his development.
What would the ideal socialist, realist symphony have been? I mean, what would the Soviets have expected? What do they want from a symphony?
Well, there hadn't really been guidelines, had there, up to that point. And you did what you wanted. And Shostakovich found out that he couldn't do what he wanted, which was the Fourth Symphony, which ends very bleakly, pianissimo C minor. He makes a comment, what if I had to end with the Fifth, optimistically fortissimo in B-flat major. And that kind of seemed one way of doing it. Prokofiev, it seems to me, found this solution of taking gallops, jolly Soviet gallops, with a nice little blithe, rustic, socialist, realist, happy peasant themes, and subverting them. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the end of the finale, but it seems to me that what begins very blithely actually can have the potential to turn extremely nasty. The mechanism almost
insistent.
Gets out of control and gets very dissonant.
How do you see the end? I mean,
yeah, I think you're right, and not just the end, but throughout this, you know, what, as you say, on the surface is a quite a pretty and, you know, socialist, realist approved thing. It has this slightly, what can begin as just an insistence, but can, you know, come through as something a bit more threatening.
Yes.
And on that, we've run out of time. So Fiona McKnight, David East, thank you very much, and thank you.
In that edition of Proms Plus, recorded earlier this evening down at the Royal College of Music, it was presented by James Jolly. The producer was Janet Tuppen. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Hanley. The second part of this prom, live here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, being given by the Rotterdam Philharmonic, conducted by its music director, Yannick Nezé-Segar. He told me he believes his orchestra is a real reflection of its city, a city badly damaged in the Second World War, and which has since kept a sense of rebuilding in its inhabitants, its architecture, and its orchestra.
This orchestra knows and stands by its own personality, which is very forward, not afraid to show some muscle, you know, but it still is also an orchestra which has immense emotional power.
It sounds like an ideal orchestra to play Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, I would say. Now, he made this famous remark that it was about the grandeur of the human spirit for official Soviet consumption. What is the symphony about? What do you feel?
I actually said to the musicians a few days ago, let's not try to add layers to it and remember to go beyond what's written. I think in the case of this symphony, it works best if we simply play what's on the page and play that joy, which in the end becomes something extremely twisted and manic and obsessive, definitely in the last movement, the second movement as well. And I think if you just play it very naturally, it comes out as this most touching, a message that's much beyond what he wrote about it.
And you heard the Promenaders telling us that they've raised £53,000 for musical charities, the Rotterdam Philharmonic. Very impressed by that, I think. Prokofiev wrote the Fifth in 1944, his first symphony for 15 years, his first since he'd returned to the Soviet Union from his self-imposed exile. Naturally, he knew all about the troubles Shostakovich had gone through, charged with flagrant modernism in his music by the regime, and how he'd fought back with his Fifth Symphony. Prokofiev worked at high speed on the symphony during the summer while staying at the composer's rest home in a converted state farm many miles from Moscow. Most of Russia's foremost composers were working there, as attested to by Prokofiev playing through the finished symphony on the piano in his cottage to Kabalevsky and Shostakovich, among others. Prokofiev was nervous, his little audience reported, perhaps because the Fifth Symphony was particularly important to him. He said he regarded it as the culmination of a long period of his creative life. He conducted its hugely successful premiere, as we've heard, in the interval early in 1945, when the fortunes of war were bringing new hope to the Soviet people. Only a few days later, the 54-year-old composer suffered concussion from a bad fall down a flight of stairs, and the effects stayed with him for the rest of his life, limiting the amount of work he could do. And here once again comes Yannick Nezet-Séguin, sashaying past the double basses and the cellos, and arriving at the rostrum to bring the Rotterdam Philharmonic to its collective feet before performing Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony.